Hello.
Hey, Danny. Good morning.
Hi, afternoon. How are you?
I'm excellent, man. Thank you. Thank you very much for taking time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for talking to me.
Yeah, man. I got to tell you, I loved reading Serving the Servant. And as we remember, Kurt, you know, for myself, I'm of an age where I remember exactly where I was when I heard Smells Like Teen Spirit for the first time. I remember when I saw the video. And then, of course, when we heard the news. You had a front row seat to a lot of amazing occurrences that you discuss in the book. Was it cathartic getting some of those stories out in the book?
Yeah, the whole process of writing the book was cathartic. Part of it was getting the stories out. Part of it was talking to people, some of whom I hadn't spoken to since then, or very little since then. Or in the case of Chris Novoselic, I'd spoken to him a lot since then, but we'd never talked about Kurt. Since Kurt died, so it was obviously a very important time in my life and in my career, and he's a once in a lifetime artist to meet and to work with. So you know, it was a roller coaster ride doing it. There were some very sad moments, but there were also some really euphoric moments, just sharing with people their happy memories of him. You know, his death is horrible, but I think there's been a little bit too much emphasis on his death and not enough on his life, and his life had a lot of inspiring things in it.
I completely agree. I personally want to focus, like, you know, similar to what you just said, on the great things he did. And one thing that I learned from this book was you really realized, and you, again, you had the front row seat, how truly ambitious he really was. When he walked in and wanted to speak to you the first time, did you feel that lightning bolt?
Well, not for the first 15 minutes, because the three of them came in, Chris, Dave, and Kurt. And Dave, I think, had just done his first gig with Nirvana a few weeks before. This was November of 1990. Bleach had been out, but they had recorded demos of some of the songs that would be on Nevermind, but not all of them, and they decided they wanted to get a manager and be on a major label. And, you know, Chris initially did a lot of the talking. We're talking about civil liberties and politics and culture. And then I was trying to get a handle on what they wanted from a manager. And a lot of bands at that time had a really almost a conviction that indie labels had a certain kind of integrity that majors lacked, and I didn't want to offend them, so I said, "Do you want to stay on Sub Pop for the next record?" And Kurt, who'd been silent up to that point, just said no, and that was very clear to me then that he was ambitious. But more to the point, watching him over a period of months, the level of attention to detail that he gave, they rehearsed for months, hours and hours a day before they went to the studio to do Nevermind. And when they rehearsed, they rehearsed. There were no partying going on. You know, he was a great artist, but also a great craftsman who took seriously the details of what he did. So he hid his ambition. He didn't want to look like he was trying to be a rock star or something like that. He wanted to maintain all of his integrity in terms of every detail of the music, the lyrics, the artwork, the videos, where they played, who he talked to. You know, he controlled all of that and was faithful to his cultural and political beliefs. But he had a vision that encompassed and somehow fused pop, heavy metal, and punk into one coherent new version of rock and roll that reached millions of people that no punk artist had ever reached. And that's what he was going for. I don't think any of us knew, even him, how big Nevermind was going to be. But there was no question that he was writing songs with choruses, and that he had an understanding of commercial sensibility, and he wanted to put his own cultural ideas into a frame that could reach millions of people, and he pulled it off.
He really did. And you know, one thing, working in radio and doing a ton of research, obviously I wasn't in radio when Nevermind was out. But when we test music still, Smells Like Teen Spirit is consistently the number one, quote-unquote, testing song of the alternative format, which which is really incredible when you think about it.
Yeah, 28 years later, yeah.
Yeah,
that's a magic song, no question about that. And, you know, I think he also, you know, he storyboarded and conceived of that video, and he did the final edit of it. He didn't like the first edit the director did. You know, it was a fully blown vision that he had. You know, the album cover, the whole thing just was kind of a genuine alternative on the mass stage to what was going on in popular rock and roll then. And yet it was also, you know, it worked commercially, and like you said, it still tests well, just the musical excellence of it. But, you know, it also had a depth to it that a lot of pop music doesn't have, and that was the magic to do both.
What can I ask you? I mean, I know it's hard to distill this, but do you have a favorite chapter in the book that you just thought, wow, man, that was, I really enjoyed writing that part of the book?
Oh, goodness. You know, they're like your children, every one of them, when you're doing it is important. I mean, I enjoyed, there's a chapter later in the book called Citizen Kurt, where I just kind of go over all of the different things that he did in the sort of social and political arena, particularly after the band became successful. When they were first emerging, he didn't want them to have too political an image because he didn't want to be lumped in with Fugazi and the Dead Kennedys and other kind of more polemic punk bands. He loved those bands and was inspired by them, but that's not what he wanted Nirvana to be. And on the other hand, when Nirvana became successful, he also didn't want them to be apathetic. He was not an anarchist. You know, he liked certain aspects of anarchist culture, but he voted. He voted for Bill Clinton in 1992. And he was very passionate about feminism and gay rights and generally the rights of anybody that was disadvantaged or oppressed. So it was fun just collecting some of the details of how he addressed that part of, you know, the canvas of what he wanted to do as an artist, as a public figure. But you know, for me, the hardest part of any book is the introduction, and that's the one I labored over and over and over and over again. Because to me, if I can get an introduction, then I know I have a book. And so that's always going to be the part of it that means the most to me, because that's the one I spent the most time on.
And you know, the introduction in the book is unlike any other because it's longer than most introductions. In a good way. I mean that.
Well,
in a good
yeah,
way.
I just wanted it's as long as it was. You know, it's like it sort of had a certain arc to it, and you know, part of it is it's very similar. That's sort of the first thing I wrote, and that's how I then sold the book. I changed the introduction somewhat after my proposal, but I didn't change it all that much. And I just wanted to kind of give an overview of how I saw him and place myself in it, and introduce the reader to you know, where I was going with it. So I don't know, you know, it's you do the best you can, but I don't actually have an end to this sentence, so maybe you have another question.
No, I do. I do. I guess my next question would be, what did you, in working with the band in that incredible time that you were able to work with them, was there any offer, because you take us inside, I feel like I'm inside the engine room with you talking about the band and how things, the inner workings that we normally don't get to read about in a book. Was there any one offer, and I'll allude to the Metallica GNR tour, that came over where you just were like, no, we're not doing that, but wow, that was nice to be asked?
Well, you know, first of all, I had a co-manager named John Silva, who's younger than me. He's incredibly successful today and had the Foo Fighters for their whole career. At that time, he was in the early stages of his career, and I brought him in because he was younger and he understood the punk culture. So between myself and John and the band, there was a real shared intuitive sense of what would and wouldn't work for them. We understood they wanted to be successful, but it had to be on their own terms, and it couldn't compromise their values. And, you know, I knew how Kurt felt about Guns N' Roses and wouldn't want to be associated with them at that time. And And, you know, because they just kind of personified at that time kind of a macho culture, and that he was an alternative to. So I knew right away. I think it was one of the Metallica's managers. He called me about it, and I just said, that there's no way. I said, and Kurt liked Metallica. I said, look, if you want to talk about a touring with Metallica, I think that's something we could talk about, because he really admires Metallica, but he's not going to want to be part of something with Guns N' Roses. And it would have been stadiums. It would have been an enormous amount of money. But I had no doubt that Nirvana was going to make money. You know, Nevermind was a phenomenon. He was one of the most talented people I'd ever met. There was no panic to make a quick buck. It was about maintaining the relationships and being a good steward as a manager of what the vision was. And that was not a close call. And, you know, then the manager took another shot and had a member of Metallica call Kurt. I forget if it was Kirk Hammett or one of the other guys. And, you know, Kurt said the same thing to him. You know, it was a non-starter. You know, more complicated, I think, decision for him was near the end of his career. There was a very lucrative offer for the band to do the Lollapalooza tour in 1994. And they... You know, I wasn't involved with all of those conversations. By this time, I was still consulting and close to kind of, I'd go on to take a record company job. I became president of Atlantic Records, but in my contract, I still could work with Nirvana, which meant working with Kurt, because the way that there were fault lines in the group, and I always kept that relationship with him that was unique. And and he asked me about, do we have to do, you know, what do you think about Lollapalooza? And I was against it for two reasons, even though it was quite a lot of money. One was, you know, he'd canceled a lot of shows. He had health problems, yep, whether it was drugs or his stomach or anything.
Yeah.
And the liability involving canceling a Lollapalooza show financially would be a lot greater than rescheduling or canceling a Nirvana show. And secondly, I had this sort of, you know, idealized notion of in my mind of what Nirvana was supposed to be in the world, which was unique and not part of some other trend or part of some category. You know, and I had worked for Led Zeppelin's manager, Peter Grant, and they were very, once they became big, it was always a Led Zeppelin show. That was it. You know, there were no, they didn't do packages. So, you know, I remember, you know, I said, look, to me, I wouldn't do it, but, you know, if you want to do it, do it. But if you're asking my advice, and he says, oh, will you tell Courtney? Because I think maybe she was more tempted by it for whatever at that time. And Hole did eventually do a Lollapalooza tour, and I'm a great fan of Hole and a good friend of Courtney's, who was kind enough to talk to me for the book.
For the book,
I'm a pro-Courtney person. But, you know, in those conversations, I think that was another one. But the main thing was just... Kurt was so brilliant and talented. It was just trying to give him space and support to do what he wanted to do. And during those 3.5 years, he did an amazing amount, but he also had some very difficult times and struggled with drugs during that time. So, you know, it was just kind of holding on for dear life, trying to be there for him. So I never doubted that that he could always make money. You know, once he was so talented and almost instantly became, you know, a figure that millions of fans deeply cared about and were interested in his work. It was just about how he could get through each cycle in a way that would feel good to him. Some of the times, which included being successful, he wanted In Utero to be successful. He wanted to have hits. You know, Unplugged was his idea, you know, but at other times it involved, you know, saying no to things that another band might have done.
And that's the art of